You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I am a woman carrying other women in my mouth. Behold, a sister, a daughter, a mother, dear friend, spirits demystified on my tongue. They gather to breathe and exhale, a dance with death we know is not the end. All these nameless bodies haunted by pellet wounds in their chests, listen for them in the saying of a name you cannot pronounce. Black and woman is a sort of magic you cannot hashtag. The mere weight of it, too vast to be held, we hold ourselves an inheritance felt between the hips, womb of soft darkness, portal of light. Watch them envy the revolution of our movement, how we break open to give life flow, while the terror of our tears, the torment of our taste, my rage is righteous, my love is righteous, my name be righteous. Hear what I am not here to say. We too have died. We know we are dying too. I am not here to say, look at me, how I died, so brutal a death. I deserve a name to fit all the horror in. I am here to tell you how if they mentioned me in their protests and their rallies, they would have to face their role in it too, my beauty too. I have died many times before the blow to the body. I have bled many months before the bullet to the flesh. We know the body is not the end. Call it what you will, but for all the handcuffed wrists of us, the shackled ankles of us, the bend over to make room for you of us, how dare we speak anything less than, I love you. We who love just as loudly in the thunderous rain as when the sun shines golden on our skin and the world kisses us unapologetically. We be so beautiful when we be. How you gonna be free without me? Your freedom tied up with mine at the nappy edge of my soul, singing for all my sisters. Watch them stretch their arms in my voice, how they fly open-chested toward your ear. Listen for Rakia Boyd, Tanisha Anderson, Yvette Smith, Ayanna Jones, Kayla Moore, Shelley Frey, Miriam Carey, Kendra James, Alberta Spruill, Tarika Wilson, Cherise Francis, Chantel Davis, Melissa Williams, Darnisha Harris, Michelle Casso, Pearlie Golden, Katherine Johnston, Eleanor Bumpers, Natasha McKenna, Shaniqua Proctor. We will not vanish in the bated breath of our brothers. Show me a man willing to fight beside me, my hand in his, the color of courage. There is no mountaintop worth seeing without us. Meet me in the trenches where we lay our bodies down in the valley of a voice. Say her name.
Our words of wisdom are from Judges, Chapter 16, verses 1 through 22.
Once Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute and went in to her. The Gazites were told, Samson has come here. So they circled round and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They kept quiet all night, thinking, let us wait until the light of the morning. Then we will kill him.
But Samson lay only until midnight. Then at midnight, he rose up, took hold of the doors of the city gates, and the two posts, pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron.
After this, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The lords of the Philistines came to her and said to her, coax him, and find out what makes his strength so great and how we may overpower him so that we may bind him in order to subdue him. And we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me what makes your strength so great and how you could be bound so that no one could subdue you.
Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that are not dried out, I shall become weak and be like anyone else. Then the lords of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not dried out, and she bound him with them. While men were lying in wait in an inner chamber, she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he snapped the bowstrings as a strand of fiber snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known.
Then Delilah said to Samson, you have mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you could be bound. He said to her, if they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like anyone else. So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. The men lying in wait were in an inner chamber, but he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread.
Then Delilah said to Samson, until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you can be bound. He said to her, if you weave the 7 locks of my hair with the web and make it tight with a pin, I shall become weak and be like anyone else. So while he slept, Delilah took 7 locks of his head and wove them into the web and made them tight with the pin. Then she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep, pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web.
Then she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me 3 times now and have not told me what makes your strength so great. Finally, after she had nagged him with her words day after day and pestered him, he was tired to death. So he told her his whole secret and said to her, a razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, then my strength would leave me. I would become weak and be like anyone else.
When Delilah realized that he had told her his whole secret, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, this time come up, for he has told his whole secret to me. Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands. She let him fall asleep on her lap, and she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. He began to weaken, and his strength left him. Then she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. When he awoke from his sleep, he thought, I will go out as other times and shake myself free.
But he did not know that the Lord had left him. So the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes. They brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze shackles. And he ground at the mill in the prison. But the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Several years ago, I took a storytelling class at the South Mountain Storytelling Institute. And on our first day of class, the professor asked us to share a story of our name. And after about 20 minutes or so, the energy in the space became immediately palpable. We were excited and chatty, and ultimately, it was this simple exercise that set the tone for the rest of the semester. We immediately felt like family, like a unit, and all with the sole goal of becoming a good storyteller. Well, since then, I've used this same icebreaker or prompt in a variety of teaching settings, and each of them different and special in their own way. But it was one in particular setting that helped me to understand the real power of sharing the story of one's name and how that can lead to real personal and social transformation. I was on a medium maximum security unit inside an Arizona State women's prison. And there were women who had never dared talk to each other for a variety of reasons. And after this exercise, the room began to be filled with laughter. It was as if the sky's glorious white puffy clouds found their way into this dark monotone tan room. Each woman was beaming at the ability to have the opportunity to share the story of their name. And at the end of the semester, so many of them shared that it was the first time that they had felt seen or actually started to see others. They were more than their last name and their inmate number. They were now a part of something different, despite the living conditions and despite how the rest of the world might see them. I bring up names because in the book of Judges, we see the use of naming or not being named as a rhetorical device to not only move the story forward, but it was actually a tool to shift the power. And before I get too into the naming part, I want to introduce some thoughts for the modern reader and hearer. It's very important for us to remember that the book of Judges is not a 21st century text. And yet here I am examining the text. Examining the stories that were told because I am curious about the possible lasting impacts of those interpretations. How have those interpretations influenced the stories that have come since then? Because after all, stories matter. For today's sermon, I'm using a womanist biblical interpretation in which to help me better understand the violence that we see throughout the book of Judges, and in particular, the violence against the women and the other in Judges 16. Womanist scholar Dr. Willa Gaffney says that this type of approach is a womanish approach, which draws from Alice Walker's 1983 definition. And it really means that we don't hesitate to talk back to the Bible or even to the Bible's God. For me, as a cultural surrogate to this congregation, when I mention womanist, I mean that I am looking at who is left out of the story, who's unnamed, and who is the most impacted by the actions that occur. Violence in the book of Judges, and actually throughout the entire Bible and the Hebrew text, actually serves as a function of the lawless era that it describes. In the case of Judges, the violence described is intertwined with the lives and the bodies of women. In fact, it is in Judges that we see women are often portrayed as both the perpetrators and the victims of violence, such as the women we find in the story of Samson, the story of Delilah. The book provides a lot of things. Most importantly, though, it provides insights about the varying types of political leadership, about gender relationships in that time and place, about power disparities, about personal and group strengths and weaknesses, as well as the social and political ethics of the time. Dr. Gaffney, who I mentioned briefly earlier, excellently describes this time of Judges as the Wild West of Israel's saga. It is where we bear witness to the migration of people and the struggles to colonize lands that are inhabited by those who were very hostile to losing their land, to losing their culture, to losing their way of being. Essentially, two of the many themes in the book is about power and who has access to it. For me, it's how does this manifest itself into the violence against women and their communities? For example, one of the earliest stories that we come across in Judges is actually the story of a woman who is subjugated to violence according to a wartime oath. In fact, we actually bear witness to a wide array of stories of violence where women and girls are subjected to increased amount of violence and rape throughout the entire book. And even if these women are just in the background, and even if these women are unnamed, their stories matter. I'm going to recap a few of those stories for you now. And this is just a little smidgen of stories that exist on violence against women in Judges. There are the indigenous women and girls of Canaan who lived through oppression and war, and whose very presence in their own land gave rise to much of the biblical angst and fear of intimate relations. Then there are the women and the girls of Midian who lived in subjugation to both women and men of Israel. That's in Judges 8. There are the women of Shechem, hundreds of who were burned alive. There are the women and girls of Benjamin in Judges 20, who were slaughtered by fellow Israelites in retaliation for not turning people over to a rape mob that actually was there to attack the Levite's low status wife in Gibeon. And then there were the women of Jabesh and Gilead, who were slaughtered and raped into marriage by the fellow Israelites to repopulate the decimated tribe of Benjamin in Judges 21. And lastly, there were the girls of Shiloh who were abducted from what should have been a safe space, a safe sacred space, by their Israelite kin, again, forced into rape and marriages to breed more Benjaminites, and that's in Judges 21. When a society gauges and celebrates stories of violence, we must begin to ask ourselves, who are the most impacted? And in this case, it would appear that it's the women in Judges' lawless error. And while I choose not to delve into the stories and the horrors of that violence more than I already have, I also choose to recognize that in this short time that we have together, that I actually cannot name all of the cultures where women experience violence. Because what we do know is that the majority of violence, that burden lies traditionally with women who are Black, Brown, Indigenous, poor, and are transgender. If we were to compare the biblical to the history of the United States, we know that there are too many untold stories of Black women and Black bodies from pre-colonial to post-colonial times, where there was an erasure of their names and their lineages, because in that country, those things were only a right afforded to persons, to white men. That means that Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks, whether they were free citizens, indentured servants, or slaves living here, there was a direct attempt to erase them and their histories. To compare the biblical to contemporary times, there's actually been recent data released by the World Health Organization that states that violence against women remains devastatingly pervasive and starts incredibly and alarmingly young. Across our lifetime, 1 in 3 women, that's around 736 million women, are subjected to physical or sexual violence by an intimate partner or sexual violence from a non-partner. And that number has remained largely unchanged over the past decade. And this violence starts early. 1 in 4 young women, ages 15 to 24, who've been in a relationship most likely have already experienced violence by an intimate partner by the time they actually reach their mid-20s. Violence against women is endemic to every country and every culture, and it caused harm to millions of women and our families. And it's only been exacerbated by the COVID-19 racial, socioeconomic, and mental health pandemics that we're still in. The World Health Organization Director General has stated recently that unlike these multiple pandemics, violence against women cannot be stopped with a vaccine, that we can only fight it with deep-rooted and sustained efforts by churches, governments, communities, families, and individuals. With the goal to change harmful attitudes, to improve access to opportunities and services for women and girls, so we can foster healthy and mutually respectful relationships. Scholar Richard Nelson states that Judges as a whole is chiefly about God, not just an idea about God, but about God's inner relationships with humanity. and about our relationship with one another. So I wonder where in the story found in Judges or in the stories of our current lives, do we bear witness to the fostering of healthy and mutually respectful relationships? Ones that could actually help to change the harmful attitudes and improve the lives of women and girls across the globe. For beloved community, when a society engages and celebrates stories of violence, we have to ask ourselves, what role does power and the influence of patriarchy have on those who are most impacted? Judges actually deals with this question. It deals with the ultimate favor of striving for a monarchy, moving towards a system of power. And the violence in Judges is actually rendered, well, sensible, because in Judges 16, Delilah and Samson actually just become two more props in this neo-imperial drama. And it's the women in the story of Samson who always appear against a patriarchal background. For example, Samson's unnamed mother. She's actually often celebrated for being a patriarchal idea of obedience, and she's ultimately rewarded with a child. So you might be asking, what does the story of our name have to do with the examination of the power in Judges? Well, let's go back to the first woman in Samson's life. It would be his mother. I mentioned earlier that she was unnamed, and yet here she was. She was sent a message from Yahweh, a high dignity that she will be with child, and a powerful one at that. While there are several barren women throughout the scriptures that were granted a similar fate, there were far less who received a message of carrying a child who will have a great impact on the world. And yet, she's not afforded the dignity of having her name remembered. The second woman that we meet in the story of Samson is that of his wife. Again, also nameless in the text, she's actually portrayed as someone who entices and betrays him, a foreshadowing of who was about to come. His wife is a foreigner, and in the narrative portion of the story, it's actually her fault that her fate ends the way that it does. Her feelings and her name are completely irrelevant to the story. She's only a character to move the plot forward, and so then her body and those of her people will actually be victims of an indescribable amount of violence. She and Delilah actually seem to share a similar position in the story, at least on the surface. And what I mean by that is, to the men in the narrative, both women are a thing. They are a possession. They are a pawn, a provocation, a bargaining chip. They actually only both serve as a plot twist. The third woman in the story of Samson is described as a sex worker. And she too, well, she's a foreigner, and not surprisingly, no name has been preserved for her. In the narrative, she serves only as a midpoint between a proper marriage and Samson's relationship with a woman who is neither a wife nor a sex worker. And that brings us to Delilah. Delilah becomes the first named woman in the story of Samson. And there are many, many interpretations that refer to her name in order to paint a picture of the type of woman that she is or may be. And some of those interpretations state that her name refers to dangling curls, or perhaps it refers to her being flirtatious. Others have stated that Delilah's name rhymes with the Hebrew word for night, Layla. And that has led many scholars and interpreters to suggest that Delilah was a lady of the night, or a sex worker. And yet, if you were to reread the text that was shared with you today, I challenge you to find the textual evidence of Delilah being a promiscuous woman, or a promiscuous woman even with a damaged reputation. And oftentimes, interpretation and the text seems to only rely on innuendo in this case. And as Dr. Gaffney points out in her book, Womanist Midrash, while the text never directly identifies Delilah as a woman of the night, it's actually not interested in saying the opposite either. There are a number of biblical commentaries written by male scholars who observed and continue to observe Delilah as a highly seductive and deceitful foreign woman who, like other women, foreign or not, use their beauty to mislead and to ultimately destroy the Israelite Samson. The writers of Judges paint Delilah as a woman who is interested in making some money, a large enough amount of money to demonstrate that she's going to be highly motivated. She's going to be motivated to succeed. And also, they portray her as someone whose tolerance for violent consequences of her act is high. Well, there are many who can point to Delilah suffering violence only in interpretation and not in the actual text. I actually argue against that. I argue that both Delilah and the wife of Samson experience the same type of violence when they are either threatened with death or threatened with the lure of such a large amount of money in order to betray Samson. In the examination of women in the Hebrew scriptures, we can see that Delilah is not playing Samson for the sport of money. She's actually playing for her life, and therefore she is willing to take a life, or in this case, to hand over a life. And for that, she is portrayed as greedy or in opposition to the God's chosen one. And it makes her betrayal a religious and a theological choice rather than an actual matter of survival. Samson's enemies don't ask either women nicely in the story of Samson to help betray him. These enemies actually issue their demands and their consequences to those demands. And because of the story and the history of violence in the Old Testament or in the book of Judges, well, when a more powerful group of people demands something from you, especially a woman, well, then that demand was not an empty threat. And if we continue to make the choice to tell the story of Delilah as a classic, dangerous, exotic, and erotic woman, well, then we seem to be okay in justifying women's subjugated roles, allowing permission for them and so many other whose stories or traits mirror them to be seen and treated a certain way. For we must always ask ourselves, how do the stories that we hear and retell reinforce violence in the world, and at whose expense? There are many examples of this type of dangerous thinking. For example, in the 1910s, Christian men set out to re-masculinize American Christianity. They sought to offset the womanly virtues that had come to dominate the faith, to insist that Christianity was and is essentially masculine and militant and warlike. In the 50s and the 60s, men like Billy Graham believed and preached that a properly ordered family was a patriarchal one. He actually believed that God had cursed women to be under man's rule, and he believed that wives must submit to husbands and man's authority. In 1979, Jerry Falwell comes along, and he teaches that America's freedom was actually being threatened by a funded program like the Domestic Violence Prevention and Treatment Act. His authority and so many like him actually depend on the fabrication of a new enemy, whether it be a woman or a foreigner. And currently, we can still see impacts of that violent rhetoric. There is a backlash against many Christian communities regarding the passage of the ERA. With or without the ERA, we have a moral challenge of reconciling women's embodied human dignity. The respect for human life will be with us, our generation. Interpreting the story of Samson and Delilah the way that we have always done it, naming Delilah while ignoring the names of so many other women, allows too many elite males to co-opt Delilah's womanly power in order to achieve their goals. So you might ask, why is it that Delilah was given a name in the story of Samson where so many women were not? Or I can only surmise. I believe that it could be because in the time of Israel's Wild West, Delilah behaved as a man would. Delilah joined a long line of biblical men whose ethical standards were perfectly appropriate for the world of the text. She worked within the patriarchal structures that were imposed on her to secure her life and liberation. And by being named in the text when so many other women were not, actually demonstrates the power behind a name. And naming, as I shared earlier, is vital to seeing who we are. It is our story. It's also a fundamental womanist practice. To remember the names, to know the stories of the names, means to remember the dead in Africana liturgies. It also is important in the current Say Her Name commitment of the Black Lives Matter movement. For knowing and naming the story of one's name can have transformational impacts on the ways in which we treat one another. During the times when I was able to present the story of your name prompt, I was witness to the shift of energy in the room. And oftentimes during those moments, I had been reminded of the Howard Thurman quote where he says, quote, one basic discovery was constantly surfacing, meaningful experiences of unity among peoples that were more compelling than all that divided and separated us. The naming and the listening to the story of someone's name allowed us to feel the presence being manifest, which in a time would bring us to see the actual humanity and dignity in one another. When we take the time to hear the story of someone's name, we immediately experience something much larger with so much greater meaning. The story in which we can begin to imagine the tú eres mi otro yo. That is, you are the other me. So I ask you, where are you now? I don't want you to think that walking away and going, oh, I know the story of someone's name, there'll be no more violence in the world. Well, that's silly. We know that naming isn't the only answer. But perhaps slowing down and listening to the story of someone's name could be a good beginning. It could actually help both the teller and the listener obtain and maintain a sense of dignity and humanity. Beloved community, I believe we are made for more than violence. And I believe that the story of one's name is the start of what reconciliation can look like. Before I end today, I want to encourage us to see the relevance and the power of this story by asking ourselves just one of these questions in the upcoming week. So how do we balance critical thinking with compassion and love? So that way we can live in a space of curiosity. If we know that Judges is chiefly about relationships, I wonder what impact does it have on us to know the story of someone's name, especially in a world that's seeped in so much violent rhetoric right now. And what if we didn't meet power with power, fear with fear, anger with anger, like both Samson and Delilah did in Judges 16? Again, beloved community, when you hear a story, spend time in that story. Think about what are the impacts of retelling that story. Who is unnamed? Who is not seen? And who is left out? Go forth onward, beloved community, and have a wonderful experience telling and listening to the stories that unfold around us every day. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information Or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.